New expressions like surrogate mothers, sperm donors, genetic parents, and state-of-the-art babies are a guide to a new social reality, according to my guest Barbara Katz-Rothman. She says that now that we are negotiating the prices for sperm and for the services of pregnant women, we are talking about the commodification of life. She fears that babies are becoming products and pregnant women are becoming unskilled workers on a reproductive assembly line. Barbara Katz-Rothman is a feminist and a sociologist. Her new book, Recreating Motherhood, examines how pregnancy and motherhood are being redefined by recent legal, social, and technological changes. She's also written books about childbirth and the ethical questions surrounding amniocentesis. Rothman is a professor of sociology at Baruch College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. With doctors, lawyers, legislators, and religious leaders all in on the debate over procreative issues, Rothman feels it's important to maintain a feminist perspective.
When you're talking about procreation, it's a much more fundamental issue. The meaning of pregnancy, of having a baby, is fundamentally different from the point of view of women, from a woman-centered view, than it is from a view centered in the needs and interests of men. Babies grow in women's bodies, in our bodies. So it's not just a special interest or a particular political slant that I'm talking about, but a woman-centered perspective of what procreation means.
You say that these are tough issues for feminists and that the old definitions of motherhood were bad, but the new ones are even worse. Would you explain that?
Well, there was a point in, you know, the kind of Leave It to Beaver America image in which what it is to be a mother is a life-engulfing role. I mean, one is a mother, and that's all that one is. And then all the work that one does and all the way that you are in the world is supposed to be understood in terms of that motherhood. So people talked about, oh, it's a good idea to educate women, they'll make better mothers. Or anything that women did was perceived in relationship to our motherhood. In response to that, some of the earlier responses of the current wave of the feminist movement was to sort of what a lot of people perceived as denigrating motherhood, to say, listen, this is just a piece of our lives. This is only part of what we do. Part of what's happened is a perception of motherhood not as an all-encompassing, engulfing life role, but as the scut work, as sort of a bunch of tasks that need to be done, many of which involve things like dirty diapers, and that one can sort of do those tasks, and that's what mothering is. And so it's almost like we went to the opposite route. Instead of speaking of motherhood as a kind of sacred calling, we've started to talk about motherhood as kind of cheap labor.
I think you're also concerned that with some of the new technologies, women are being seen as just the vessel in which the fetus is housed.
Absolutely. I mean, once you get a perspective, and this is where this difference between a woman-centered and an outside-centered view of pregnancy, from a perspective that women hold, when we are pregnant, the pregnancy is part of us and the fetus is part of us and we are one becoming two. When you take an externalized kind of vision of this and you say, well, you take a man's seed and you put it in a woman's body and a baby grows. And then the baby is perceived as being inherently, essentially there in its genetic component, and the woman is the place. And so pregnancy becomes a time, a place, a spot in which fetuses develop. And our entire cultural shift over the last, it's not really that long, over the last two decades at most, has been to develop this image of the fetus as something that the entire culture is aware of. And when I talk to undergraduates and I say, show me with your hands what a fetus looks like in utero, and they can hold their hands in that distinctive curled shape.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do that, they always put the head up because that's the way they see it. Okay, or sometimes they'll do it lying on its back, curled up. When I ask them, okay, now picture a pregnant woman. Where is that baby in the woman? They have no idea. They don't even perceive the fetus as being in the upside-down position they really are. They have no idea where the woman's body is. It's like the pregnant women have become sort of invisible in the making of the fetus as visible. And so the focus in the new procreative technology is on this fetus, and the woman becomes maybe a barrier, maybe, you know, at worst a barrier, at best a site for fetal development.
My guest is Barbara Katz-Rothman, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, Recreating Motherhood. There isn't much surrogacy yet. There aren't that many, you know, surrogate mother contracts yet. But do you think that the issue surrounding surrogate mothers is important in setting the tone and determining the terms for the current debate over the relationship of mother and fetus, mother and baby.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that two things happen. One is a certain way of thinking made surrogacy a thinkable thought. There's no new technology there. And bear in mind, the technology that they're using is the technology of artificial insemination. It's been done with human beings for over 100 years. It's not new technology. So it had to be a new way of thinking about pregnancy that made that, as I say, a thinkable thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then having created the idea that, yes, that woman is pregnant, but that baby isn't hers, that a woman has a baby in her belly, but she's not the mother, changes further. It pushes you further along the line in this changing thinking about motherhood. So that first you have the notion that pregnancy is just this place in which precious babies develop. And then you say, well, so why does it need to be any one particular place? Why does it need to be this woman? If this woman can't house a fetus, how about another woman house the fetus? And so the pregnancy is seen not as a relationship, not as a part of the woman's motherhood, a part of her life, but as a housing issue. And once you start thinking that way, you say, well, listen, she should be able to rent out this space in her body like you could rent out the spare back bedroom. And so you begin to push to this notion that people can purchase pregnancy as a service. Like I was saying, motherhood is cheap labor. That you can purchase the service. And since it's only menial physical work anyway, in our society, and specifically women's work, it's pretty low-paid work. Once that concept is there, even if it is only the 500-600 couples involved or whatever we've got now in the country, you start saying, look, if Susan X cannot smoke while she's pregnant because she's carrying a baby under contract, then why should Joan X be able to smoke while she's pregnant? Because after all, that baby isn't just hers. And you start looking at every garden variety, ordinary occurring pregnancy out there as a site for the development of a precious fetus. And so the surrogacy concept, the concept that just because you're pregnant doesn't necessarily mean you are currently the mother to that child, begins to raise questions about any pregnancy. What makes... And I remember sitting and listening to a bunch of lawyers talking about this, and I just thought, like, I felt like Alice in Wonderland at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. A bunch of lawyers were sitting around seriously trying to discuss if there is anything at all special in a pregnant woman's relationship to her fetus that distinguishes her from anybody else's relationship to the fetus. So if I couldn't blow smoke in at a pregnant woman because I'd harm her fetus and could be sued for doing it, well, who says she can smoke? If I couldn't poison her because I'd be doing damage to her fetus, who says she can do something we might think of as poisoning the fetus?
So you think surrogacy also shows the way that society is beginning to value fetuses and babies more than pregnant women and mothers?
More than, and I think what's more profoundly important here is as distinct from.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fetus becomes the issue. And it's very rarely placed as which do we value more, but really as if the woman was kind of irrelevant housing to the essential thing that's happening, which is the growth of the fetus.
In your world, if you could rewrite laws and contracts and so on, there would be no surrogacy.
Yeah, I find the concept is abhorrent. If you want to talk about women selling their babies, then I'm not thrilled with the idea, but I'm ready to discuss it. I'm uncomfortable with it for all the reasons we've always been uncomfortable with baby sales. But the surrogacy concept is a worse one because it says, well, it's not really her baby anyway. So you can say that she's not selling her baby, she's selling her labor, whatever. But you've already developed this schism between the woman and the baby as the baby is part of her body. I mean, at the point that it's physically part of her.
But what if a woman is willing, you know, is glad to enter into that relationship, and to her she thinks it's really worth the money that she's going to get rent out her body?
Well, then let's talk about the issues of baby sales. Let's talk about this is something that a woman can produce that's highly valued. There are good, strong arguments against it. People have made arguments for and against things like kidney sales, too. You know, what if somebody really, truly wants $10,000, they have two healthy kidneys, people are standing cash in hand ready to buy, why don't we let them buy? And it's an interesting, difficult debate. My own gut feeling is not to commercialize these relationships. But surrogacy needs to be seen the same way. We don't talk about why don't you just rent out your body for the duration of a kidney transplant, and it's not really your body then, it becomes their kidney. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's your kidney. It's in your body. And I'm saying it's her fetus. It's in her body. It's hers.
Would you have an alternate for the surrogate contract?
What do you mean by
an alternate kind of relationship between a pregnant woman and a woman or a man who wants to adopt a child, or you know, or who wants to contract with someone to have a baby that they would
adopt,
hand over? Yeah,
yeah. Well, I think we've already got adoption in place, and I know that we've got a lot of problems in adoption. A lot of things need to be worked out, but not in. Almost in the opposite direction, to remove the commercialization or to remove the pressures.
I guess I'd like to know what you think the best kind of contract would be in an adoptive type of relationship.
Well, in an ideal situation, in an ideal world, there wouldn't be a whole lot of women who are giving babies up for adoption. I mean, you have to look at where those babies are coming from. They're coming from women who did not have alternatives earlier on in terms of contraception, some of them in terms of abortion, some of them in terms of raising their own children. Adoption is hardly ever anybody's first choice thing to do in the world. What I'd really like to do is have a baby and give it up for adoption is not something you hear very often, which is why surrogacy came up. You know, will you do it for $10,000? And the brokers got around the illegality of that by saying, well, it's not really adoption because whoever sperm it is, that's whose baby it really is. Noel Keene, the guy who brokered the Baby M case, says that that Mary Beth Whitehead gave the baby back to its father. Like, he gave her a sperm, she turned it into a baby and gave it back. But the sperm was the essence all along. The notion of adoption as a woman's last resort is problematic. Introducing money to entice people to enter into that, you know, if you really need $10,000, you'll enter into that, doesn't make it less problematic.
Now, what you're saying about surrogacy also has relevance for the fetal rights issues. And why don't you explain what fetal rights, what the concept of fetal rights is?
Well, starting with the notion that the fetus is another. Starting with the notion that that you have among some parts of our society, though it's certainly a minority view, that from the moment of conception there's a person there. Then you start talking about rights, as we all have, you know, rights to vote or whatever. And so you're saying, okay, which are the rights that are relevant to fetuses? Obviously not voting rights and driving rights. And then you start talking about certain essential rights, and they talk about the right to life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of the paths in. Of the current anti-abortion movement is to focus on the fetus as a separate being and discuss its rights vis-a-vis the mother. You also find this being used sometimes to coerce women into medical decision-making against their will. We've seen some really horrific forced cesarean section cases where women did not want surgery and were, you know, pretty much handcuffed to tables to have surgery against their will. And the argument that was used is that the fetus has rights, including rights to certain kinds of medical decision-making. Women incarcerated against their will to get certain kinds of medical treatments for their fetuses. Underlying it is a kind of notion that the fetus and the woman are these separate beings. If you substitute another vision, that says the woman and the fetus are a unit. There's one person there. And then you start talking about the responsibilities of the rest of the society to help that unit, to help that mother and her baby. You come up with some much more humane alternatives.
Yeah, you said that in a woman-centered model, you wouldn't have separate rights of the fetus and the mother. They'd be seen as one flesh. How does that change the issue if you see the baby is not planted within the mother, but the baby as the flesh of the mother's flesh, part of her?
Well, it changes a lot of issues. It means that your focus is not on getting through or at or to, not seeing the mother as a barrier, as a hindrance to optimal medical care of a fetus or something, but that you perceive a social relationship. You see that human beings inherently, innately come into the world in a social relationship. And you don't work to destroy that relationship or to ignore that relationship, but you work in support of that relationship.
So you think that the fetus should have no separate rights from the pregnant mother, the pregnant woman?
Give me a for instance.
Of when they should have it?
Yeah.
Well, let's use the example that you used of a forced cesarean section. A pregnant woman is dying. She doesn't want to have a C-section. Her husband doesn't want to have the C-section, but there's legal intervention that says to save the life of the baby, she has to have that C-section.
Okay, what's real interesting, of course, is the scenario you're describing happened already, and the woman did not want the section. The section was done. The fetus died. The mother died. The fetus died in a couple of hours, the mother in a couple of days. One of the real interesting things that's happened around all of these forced cesarean section cases is that more often than not, the doctors are wrong anyway. Where they said a fetus was in distress, fetus turns out to be just fine. Where they say there was a placenta previa, she'll never birth vaginally. The woman fled the jurisdiction, birthed vaginally. Medicine is not omniscient here, and they don't necessarily know for sure what they're doing. Part of the question is, whose errors do we want to trust? The errors of the individual woman, the errors of the state and medicine combined. The state and medicine combined have had a pretty bad history of errors around procreation. These are the people who brought its various eugenics movements. Individual women have had a much better history of protecting their babies. On the whole, the people who have been most helpful to babies have been mothers. People who have actually made sacrifices and done what needed to be done for babies and been right have been more often mothers than anybody else. So just on you know, who knows what they're doing, there's a question of why assume that the doctors necessarily know better when their track record, even when they brought it to the courts, hasn't been that good. There's a wonderful article in the New England Journal of Medicine demonstrating exactly that, that when they forced these sections, they were very often wrong. So that's one issue. The other issue is that lots of us make decisions that are not necessarily the best for everybody else on the planet. If you have a 3-year-old child and you decide to do some, say, cosmetic surgery, and it's somewhat risky, but you decide you really want this fat suctioned off your thighs or whatever it is people do, you're taking a risk of dying in surgery and leaving a motherless 3-year-old, which is a pretty evil thing to do, all things considered. But we say, listen, the state has no right to step in there and say, you can't do this because of the risks to a child. If somebody wants to become a test pilot and they have kids, they have a right to do that. Pregnancy is not different in that sense, okay? It's a social relationship. Things that we do with our own bodies do affect other people. Parenting invariably does that throughout the life course of parenting. Making pregnant women a separate category of legal being, you know, everybody has certain rights except for pregnant women, is incredibly dangerous route to go.
You were just telling us that you don't think that the fetus should have rights separate from the rights of the pregnant woman. How would that apply in abortion? Do you think that it seems like a very relevant question to the question of abortion?
Sure. Women have abortions usually to get unpregnant. And the issue of the fetus is not the issue that's being focused on. It's the avoiding of creating a baby.
Mm-hmm.
The fetal right end of that wants us to think that a baby is there from the moment of conception or sometime real shortly after, that the baby is the genetic material. When an egg and a sperm join, bingo, you got a baby. What I'm saying is that a pregnancy is a social relationship. The decision to end that relationship is one that comes when a woman gives the baby up for adoption. It's one that comes when a baby is, you do prenatal diagnosis and you find, say, Down syndrome, and a woman decides not to continue the pregnancy. More typically, what women are doing is not ending a relationship, but choosing to avoid one. They're choosing to avoid motherhood. Women don't have abortions because they don't value motherhood. They have abortions because they think motherhood is a terribly important thing. Otherwise, they could just have those babies, and frankly, they could sell them. White women could sell their babies for a lot of money. On the, you know, so-called black market for white babies. But women don't do that precisely because they do value motherhood. And so what they're trying to do is avoid motherhood. In a sense, we do that with contraception, too. You know, in January, when a woman is ovulating, if she contracepts, then that's a particular baby that won't be born in September if that egg carried the dominant gene for brown eyes. That's a brown-eyed September baby that's not going to happen. If conception occurs, if a sperm joins up with that egg, well, you've got a more specific genetic potential that's not going to happen if you abort it. From the perspective of women, I'm not sure that it's all that different to do contraception or to do an early abortion. What you're doing is not entering into a motherhood relationship.
You think that a woman should have the right to abort until she feels that the fetus has quickened, until she feels that the fetus has become a baby inside her, until she feels it move and feels it enter into its own. Is that right?
Well, I'm not talking about rights up to point of quickening. I'm saying that for most women, the point of quickening makes it very, very hard to terminate a pregnancy. And that it's much harder to terminate a pregnancy after you've experienced a baby. That before that point, women can terminate a pregnancy. And it's taken a whole lot of fancy technology to try to convince us that there's a baby in there by showing us pictures of things that are like an inch long and say, look how humanoid that looks, and it's got all its genetic potential, and so on and so forth. But the experience of being a month pregnant is not really a mother-child experience. The experience of feeling a foot jab in your ribs begins to be a much more real social relationship. Women find it very much harder to terminate pregnancies after that point. One of the just strange ironies that's brought to us by this kind of medical technology we're developing is that on the one hand, we use all this fancy technology to say, how can a woman terminate a pregnancy however early? Because look, you've got all this genetic potential and you have this embryo or fetus already in there forming, etc. And on the other hand, we turn around and say to a woman who's very well into a pregnancy, who's felt a baby move, who's started to, you know, knit booties, who's really into the pregnancy, we say to her, well, your baby has some horrible genetic disease, and that's a good reason for terminating the pregnancy, and that would be a therapeutic abortion, that would be a medically acceptable abortion. And interestingly, people then turn around and say to her, aren't you lucky to have the opportunity to terminate the pregnancy at this point? So that woman who's grieving the loss of her baby, we say, well, she's had a medically acceptable therapeutic abortion to get rid of a genetic defect. And she's saying, I lost my baby. My baby died. And other women are saying, look, I just want to get unpregnant. I don't know how I got into this mess. I was contracepting, and oh my God, my period is 2 weeks late. I want to get out of this mess. To her, we flash these photographs and say, but there's a baby there. So the technology is being used in fascinating ways to make women's experience of the pregnancy match societal needs.
You said that you think liberal feminism has failed on some of these issues. What do you mean by liberal feminism, and how do you think it's failed?
Well, partly it's the kind of thing we're talking about, a way of thinking of focusing on this equality issue and accepting the definitions that are existent already in the society of personhood as essentially what men are, and then talking about women as comparable to. I'll give you a very specific example. Men have seed and women have seed. Liberal feminism has said men's seed is no more valuable than women's seed. Women and men equally contribute to the growth of a baby, and therefore a baby is half his and half hers. Taken as a response to a patriarchal image which says babies are the children of men out of the bodies of women, or Mrs. John Smith bears John Smith Jr., that liberal feminist standpoint looks like a great leap forward. You know, the baby is just as much hers as his because she too has seed. What I'm saying is, well, wait a minute. Who said seed was so important? The only thing that made it so important was that men had it. What if we go back and say not babies are half his, half hers, and might just as well have grown in the backyard, but say babies grow in the bodies of women. That's a very special and unique relationship. That nurturance is the determining relationship. As other people nurture a baby after its birth and through its life, those people too come to have a relationship with that child, and that relationship may be as important, as fundamental, more important than the relationship of the birth mother, but that nurturing relationship is what we'll look at, not where the sperm came from or even where the egg came from.
I think it's fair to say that there's no one feminist stand on the issues that we've been discussing. And that, you know, even in feminist circles, there are different thoughts on surrogate parents, on fetal rights, on issues like that. Does that disturb you? Do you wish that there was unanimity,
or
do you think that's impossible and just fine?
No, I'm not looking for a party line, you know, that we could have a platform or something on total agreement. On the other hand, I think that we do need to push towards what I really think is best called a woman-centered perspective on this. Like you talk, you just use the phrase surrogate parents. That's wonderful gender-free language. What on earth would a surrogate father be? We don't even know. I mean, there's no idea of what that would mean even.
Right.
But you get caught up in it. I've seen it in the in the literature on adoption. They talk about birth fathers. Now, good God, what is a birth father? Does that make any sense? You need to have a woman-centered understanding of this. And then we start talking about, okay, so what are our policies, kinds of issues that we need to figure out? What are the solutions to the problems that exist? And there you can have the wonderful diverse voices of different women coming from different places with different sets of needs. There are class issues and race issues that are involved in all of this. And sure, there's not going to be a single feminist voice. But what we really need to do, I think, is sort of take back the territory and say pregnancy and childbirth are things that happen in the lives and bodies of women, and our understanding of what they are needs to grow out of the lives of women.